They fly directly to Moscow and the plane lands. And Nixon gets up again and he comes up to Louis and says, "Louis, I mean it. If there's anything I can do for you, just let me know." And Louis looks down and he's got his trumpet case and he's got this satchel. And in the satchel is his sheet music and his stash, because Louis never went at night without smoking some pot. So he hands Nixon the satchel and says, "Sure, Mr. Vice President, you can carry my satchel." And Nixon says, sure. He walks off. Of course, Nixon doesn't have to go through customs. Louis goes through with his corn, and on the other side of customs, they meet up again, and Nixon hands him his satchel. He says, "I'm so glad to meet you." He said that, and Louis says, "Well, the pleasure is all mine, Mr. Vice President."
That's the voice of Jonathan Taplin, who, among other things, is the author of a new book called The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life. And what a life it's been for Jonathan. Welcome to Rock Conversations. I'm Rob Bob. Thanks for tuning in today. And if you would, please remember to subscribe to us anywhere you get your podcasts, whether it's Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, or Audible, or elsewhere. And take a few seconds as well, if you would, please, to rank our various episodes. Jonathan Taplin was talking there about former Vice President Nixon and Louis Armstrong, quite the combo. And he's recounting a story that he heard from Miles Davis. We'll hear the full story in just a little bit. And while it's fun to make light of Louis Armstrong's stash, Jonathan does something very interesting in his book, and he talks about some of the artists like Keith Richards and Eric Clapton, among others, who had quite an issue with substance use and cleaned up, and their music got even better. It's odd in these rock and roll memoirs where someone will actually focus on sobriety, but Jonathan does a nice job of it, and it's worth noting. He talks about Bob Dylan and the band, George Harrison, Janis Joplin, Mick Jagger, Jimi Hendrix, and the aforementioned Eric Clapton, among others. So let's not waste any more time. Let's get to our rock conversation with Jonathan Taplin.
Oh, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back again.
I want to do something that I've never done in an interview before, because your book is so thorough. It's got so many highlights that I don't know where to start. So instead, I dog-eared a bunch of pages that I found something in it very interesting, or where I found something very interesting. And I'd like to just kind of randomly throughout our conversation, go to one of those dog-eared pages and either read directly a sentence or two, or just pick up on the topic. So let me start with the page 203. Now, this wasn't completely random, because obviously I'd picked it first to start the interview. You were kind of instrumental, no pun intended, in the marriage, however short it might have been, of Bob Dylan and David Geffen. How did that come about, and were you played along the way a little?
Yeah, I probably was played. I met David Geffen in Hollywood, and this was in early 1974. And he invited me to a bunch of parties at his house with Jack Nicholson and Warren Beatty. And it was pretty, you know, it was clearly the Hollywood inside crowd. And I had just produced Mean Streets, so I had, you know, been a newcomer to Hollywood. And then he asked me if I would introduce him to Robbie Robertson. And so I did, and we had a dinner together. And then next thing I knew, he was taking Robbie Robertson and his wife to Paris on a private jet with him and Joni Mitchell, which is memorialized in the famous Joni Mitchell song, "I Was a Free Man in Paris."
Absolutely. Great tune and a great story with the way she captured him.
Right. And then he asked Robbie to introduce him to Bob Dylan. And that dinner happened. And literally during the course of that dinner, Geffen came up with this idea that Bob should do a tour and to support that tour, he should record an album for Geffen's label, Asylum, which became Planet Waves, with the band. And they basically laid out the incredible amount of money Bob could make on this tour and the large advance he would get from David Geffen for doing the album. And then there would be a live album from the tour. And by this point, I'm kind of out of the picture.
Right? Yeah.
I didn't go to Paris on the private jet. And, you know, I realized later that he was basically trying to screw Clive Davis, who had run Columbia Records. And obviously Bob had been on Columbia Records since his very first album in 1962. So, and Bob's contract happened to be up. And so David got two albums out of Bob, but then Bob went right back to Columbia Records. And I don't think he ever talked to David Geffen after that tour.
You've dealt with, you know, we're talking obviously about Geffen, a mogul, but you've dealt with, in the course of your career, some other big personalities. And I'd like you to reflect on a couple of them. Albert Grossman would be one, the manager for Dylan and others. And then Bill Graham, from Bill Graham Presents and the Fillmore East and other venues.
Well, Albert was a curious, very kind of inward, almost introspective character. You know, the classic notion of a music manager is a kind of hail fellow well-met, backslapper, you know, just engaging personality. But Albert was not that at all. Albert was very interior, pretty quiet. And he only would get angry if he felt his artists were getting screwed. And you know, you can see that a little bit in that Dylan film, Don't Look Now, Don't Look Back. But he's also unique. I mean, he took a liking to me, which was great. And I found him to have a good sense of humor. And, you know, physically, he was very imposing. He had long gray hair pulled back in a ponytail, little Ben Franklin glasses. He looked like Ben Franklin had come into the 20th century. wore bespoke suits, but, you know, had a really interesting kind of sense of style. But his other thing was that he believed that it was important for artists to have a certain kind of mystery around them. And so, for instance, he never, in the mid-60s, there were all these TV shows on network television showing rock music. There was Shindig and Hullabaloo, and these were the thing for music artists to do. And Albert said, shows are deaf. And so he didn't let any of his artists go on those shows. And it was only until Ed Sullivan called that you were allowed to go on television.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Makes sense in a way, though.
Yeah. And so none of Albert's artists were kind of widely seen on television at all. And of course, that air of mystery around Bob Dylan and the band accrued to them in the sense so that when the band went out on tour in 1969, nobody had ever seen them on stage. And they were just like this mysterious mountain folk that come down from the mountains to San Francisco. And for their very first gig, they played three nights sold out at Winterland, which is 7,000 people each night in San Francisco, which is not that big a city, you know? So, I mean, pretty amazing to start your career that way. And actually, it worked that way.
And Bill Graham, I don't think he was really laid back all the time from what I've read.
He never let you forget that he had fled the Nazis, come across Europe into Portugal, somehow gotten through Casablanca to the United States. I mean, he was a refugee in his heart, and he was a hard ass. And Bill and I had some great times, but I also had some hard times. I didn't talk about this in the book, but Bill, at one point when the Lower East Side was getting a little funky, decided that he was going to let go his lease on the Fillmore East, and he was going to put his concerts on at the Metropolitan Opera House.
Oh, interesting choice.
Classy joint. Yeah. Right? So, yep. And for the debut of this new Bill Grant Presents at the Metropolitan Opera House, he wanted the band to be the first group that did that. So I went down with my sound man to look at the Metropolitan Opera House. And my sound man had this little machine that would put out a very large sound and then record when it would come back and for echoes. And it turned out that the Metropolitan Opera House was designed for essentially acoustic singers. In other words, people didn't have microphones, and the acoustics were such, and it had a glass wall at the back of it, that for rock and roll, it was just a disaster. You would hit a drum, and then the sound of the drum beat would come back at you towards the stage.
Oh, my. Like a half That's a second deadly. Later. Yeah.
And so I called Bill, and I said, Bill, this is not going to work. We're not going to do that. And he was so pissed off that after all I've done for you, and you won't do this for me and everything. And he even wrote about it in his autobiography. He blamed me for the fact that never really worked out.
He should have thanked you, I think, based on what you're describing.
Yeah, well, he actually did do one concert there with The Who, and the thing was a complete disaster acoustically. It was just, and he never did it after that.
We're talking with Jonathan Taplin. His book is called The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life, and oh, what a life it's been. One thing, a theme you kind of repeat at least a few times, I found it very interesting and really appreciated it. Certainly, you've been exposed to artists who have struggled with substances, but you highlight those who struggled and then got better, got clean, got sober. Some of them include Keith Richards and Eric Clapton. What did you see in those individuals when they realized that they needed to clean up a little bit? And how did their lives, and for that matter, their music improve?
Well, let's start with Eric. I mean, my experience with Eric was fascinating in the sense that I was asked by George Harrison to help produce the concert for Bangladesh. And it's astonishing to think that was 50 years ago this year.
It really is. Yeah.
And so Eric was one of the members of the band that George had assembled. It was Billy Preston and Klaus Voormann and Ringo Starr and Jim Keltner. And Eric was going to be the lead guitar player. So Eric constantly missed the flights from London to get to New York to rehearse with the rest of the band and didn't literally show up until the last day, just before the concert was on, did no rehearsal with the band and was struggling with heroin addiction. And it was very hard. But he eventually got on stage and he did a good job. And then a couple of years later, he had a complete tragedy in which his very young son was in a hotel room and left with a nanny, with a babysitter, and the son crawled out the window and fell to his death. And I think, although Eric wasn't at fault for that, I think it shocked him in a really deep way that he realized he was not paying attention. He was not being conscious. And he describes in his own autobiography the point of feeling so deeply hurt that he had to get down on his knees and begin praying to a God that he wasn't even sure existed and he had heard about from his parents but had not, he was not a religious person. And, but somehow that helped him.
The other thing, if I could just interject, you know, that I found very interesting, if not admirable, of Clapton, is that once he got clean and sober, he still had some creative juice left in him. A lot of times we see artists who maybe have just run out of creativity even before they get clean and sober. But Eric came back with some great albums.
Oh, totally. Totally agree. And you know, I mean, he's in store. He's very healthy right now. So Keith,
Keith, let's talk about Keith a little bit.
A little more complicated. You know, after Bangladesh, I was asked by the Stones management to come interview with them, and they were holed up in the south of France in what is known as tax exile. They were trying to escape the British version of the IRS. And so they were living in luxury in Saint-Jean-Cap-Ferrat, and I went to this mansion that Keith had, this villa, and supposedly had a 1 o'clock meeting with the band. And by 3 o'clock, Charlie Watts showed up, and he was the responsible member of the band. And by 4:30, Mick showed up and essentially started the meeting and would keep asking the butler to go upstairs and roust Keith out of bed and get him to come down. And finally, around 7 p.m., Keith shows himself there. And I mean, I just took one look at him, and he was scratching his neck and drinking multiple espressos. And I just knew, you know, this was 100 miles of bad road on his face. And so I respectfully declined the next morning, even though I hadn't been offered the job, to say I wasn't going to take going to do that, because it had been hard enough to get Eric Clapton on stage once. The idea of having to do that every day is just more than, you know, it was just comes under the life's too short point of view. So I believe that what happened with Keith was that his wife, Patty, basically told him to get straight or she was going to leave him. And I think he took that. He understood that that was more important to him than the love of heroin, and he did get himself straight. I do believe that you can revive from this. You know, I tell stories about Miles Davis. I mean, Miles Davis had a horrible heroin addiction too, and managed to get past it and get straight. And yet, you know, some others in the book, I mean, obviously Janis Joplin was somebody that I cared for a lot and knew well and had hung out with. And, you know, she would go on and off it. And I clearly didn't know how strong the heroin she was taking at a point in her life when she was in a very good place. You know, so, I mean, it's a tragedy.
You mentioned Miles Davis. By the way, we're talking on Rock Conversations with Jonathan Taplin. He's the author of the new book called The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life. It's an excellent read. In it, you talk about Miles Davis, and he told you, if I'm not mistaken, this is one of the stories I had kind of dog-eared and actually had opened up to while you were giving that answer, so that, you know, the segue and the transition are perfect. Page 49, if I'm not mistaken, he told you a story that involved Louis Armstrong and Richard Nixon. And I'm going to let you take the story from there.
Sure. So we were, the band was playing the Hollywood Bowl, and we were allowed to choose anybody we wanted to be the opening act. And so we chose Miles Davis, and Miles was in the Bitches Brew theory, you know, level of, so he was playing this kind of wild music that was kind of fusion. It wasn't pure jazz, but it wasn't rock either. And so in the, you know, dressing rooms beforehand, we were hanging with him, and he told us this story about Louis Armstrong. So Louis Armstrong had been a big, big supporter of Martin Luther King. It's something that people don't really realize, but a lot of the financing of King's early work came from Louis Armstrong. And the State Department kept trying to get Louis Armstrong to go on a world tour because, of course, the Soviets were using those pictures of young girls being escorted by military soldiers into schools as propaganda, like this is what America is. This is this racist country. And if you're Black, you need a soldier to get you into school. So Armstrong kept declining these invitations because he didn't think that Eisenhower had done enough to support the civil rights movement. But finally, in 1959, he agreed to go to Moscow for a big American exhibition in Moscow. And so he and his band are in the Paris airport called Orly, and they're waiting in the VIP lounge to go to Moscow. And in walks Richard Nixon with two Secret Service agents. And Nixon is going to Moscow as well for this same exhibition. Those of you who are historically minded have probably seen the famous picture of Nixon and Khrushchev having a debate in front of an American refrigerator, which was the symbol of, like, this is what America is. So anyway, so Nixon comes up to Armstrong and says, Satchmo, you are an American treasure. You know I play jazz piano, and I'm such a fan. I cannot tell you what a fan I am of yours. And if there's anything I can ever do for you, just let me know. And Louis said, well, thank you very much, Mr. Vice President. I appreciate it and everything. And they go down, and eventually they all get ushered into the Pan Am and take up the whole first class section of the plane. They fly directly to Moscow, and the plane lands, and Nixon gets up again, and he comes up to Louis and says, Louis, I mean it. If there's anything I can do for you, just let me know. And Louis looks down, and he's got his trumpet case, and he's got this satchel, and in the satchel is his sheet music and his stash, because Louis never went at night without smoking some pot. So he hands Nixon the satchel and says, sure, Mr. Vice President, you can carry my satchel. And Nixon says, sure, sure, and walks off. Of course, Nixon doesn't have to go through customs. Louis goes through with his corn, and on the other side of customs, they meet up again, and Nixon hands him his satchel. He said, I'm so glad to meet you. He said that, and Louis says, well, the pleasure is all mine, Mr. Vice President.
Oh, I bet it was. I bet it was. There are a number of times in your career when you encountered either elected officials or other politicians. One is when you had a screening for your film Under Fire. And it seemed like Alexander Haig, the man who is in charge, maybe didn't quite take too kindly to the story you were depicting on screen. How would you describe his reaction?
So this is a movie called Under Fire, which is a story about the Nicaraguan Revolution. And obviously it depicts the CIA as kind of a manipulative power below that. And in some ways it depicts the revolutionaries as good people. And this was very counter to what the Reagan administration was putting forth, which was they were trying to push the Contras, which was this counter-revolutionary force. And, you know, while Jimmy Carter had supported the Sandinistas and given them money and everything, but Reagan was going to get rid of them and force them out, and whether through a coup or whatever of things. And so, you know, Orion made the mistake of inviting Alexander Haig and five of his staffers to the screening at the MPAA in Washington. And literally in a very public gesture in the middle of the movie, Haig gets up and walks out of the movie.
If I were in your shoes at that time, I think I would have looked and thought, that's a badge of honor. Now I know we've done something well. Were you pretty proud of that moment? I mean, not too many people can claim that.
No, and I'm proud of the movie, too. It's a good movie.
I often say that if I could go back in time, if there is an era, and this podcast, Rock Conversations, kind of focuses on it. I call it the halcyon days of rock and FM radio, the 70s, 80s, maybe the early 90s. But right. I think I would go back to Southern California. I was too young at the time. I was alive. But, you know, Southern California, early to mid 70s, when FM radio was really churning along, where you had the singer-songwriters. Let's talk about that era, because you were, you know, you were either there and or part of it. I love how you refer, and we're both fans of Jackson Browne, but you talk about his song, The Pretender, and how it just encompasses maybe what we were all kind of seeking at some point in our lives.
Yeah. I mean, to me, Jackson is a great poet, and that sense of angst that, you know, those of us who were old enough to have gone through the late 60s and had the great disappointment of the death of Martin Luther King and the death of Bobby Kennedy all within 2.5 months, then kind of surrendered to another thing. Jackson calls it the struggle for the legal tender, right?
I mean, which you work into the book later. There's a little right. quote in that. Yeah. Yeah.
And in the sense that, oh, well, screw it. I'm going to just have some fun. I'm going to find a girl that makes me excited. I'm going to play my music. I'm going to work and get some money. And I'm going to let those dreams, those idealistic dreams that we had, go by the wayside. And that is a kind of both sad and incredibly truthful statement. And in that sense, I think that song and the songs of Don Henley with the Eagles in that period and all of that. I mean, if you think about, you know, Life in the Fast Lane or any of those kinds of that period, it's a really wonderful time in music.
Did you have, you mentioned a few, but did you have a favorite group or solo artist from that time period?
I would say that Jackson was my favorite from that period, you know, and then to be eclipsed a little bit later by Bruce Springsteen. But you know, I would say one other thing, because you mentioned FM radio and what a powerful tool it was at the time. If you would tour in 1971, as I did with the band, you would find that in every city, there was a sound. So let's just say that I started my tour in San Antonio, Texas. So there was Sir Douglas Quintet and this very kind of Tex-Mex sound. And then you would get up to Austin, Texas, and Woody, you know, you'd have Willie Nelson and, you know, some of that feeling in Austin. And then you'd go over to New Orleans and there would be Dr. John and Alan Toussaint. And then you would come up to Memphis and there would be Stax Volt and Otis Redding. And then you would go over to Detroit and you'd hear Motown. And so that, and in California, you know, the sounds coming out of San Francisco were incredibly different than what was coming out of Southern California at that time, like the Beach Boys and then Buffalo Springfield and eventually Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, you know, I mean, so that sense that there were regional pockets of music, each of which was supported by its local radio stations, made for a much richer quilt of musical content than once Reagan allowed Clear Channel to buy up all the local radio stations and then program them from one place so that you had a uniform sound everywhere. I mean, there was a top 50 and that was it. And it was the same in every city.
It's crap. I mean, there's no other way to describe right. it. I mean, it, you know, right. We could go into the financial aspect of it, you know, over leveraged, cost cutting measures, but you're right. It lost by and large, not everywhere, but it lost the local feel, the local flavor. Where, like you say, certain stations in Chicago, might play some local artists that weren't getting played elsewhere. Did you have a favorite station or two in the 70s in Southern California?
Well, you know, what was that? There was Donahue. I can't remember.
Yeah, Donahue, if I'm not mistaken, started what later became KROQ. It was a Pasadena station.
Yeah.
And then he went up to the Bay Area and kind of did something very similar.
He was at K-Rock at the beginning.
And then Shadow Stevens, who many of us know from American Top 40, he actually had a big hand in programming, kind of mainstreaming both K-Rock and then later KMET, which was owned by Metro Media and had stations across the country. But they were big dogs in the in the FM radio long before the classic classic rock format we know. So they were playing new artists. They were playing established artists, new songs, something we hardly ever hear anymore. So it was a very exciting and entertaining time. Exile on Main Street, as we jump around here, you had just a little role in putting that album cover together. And I'm joking when I say little, you had more than a little role, but this is another story that I will shut up and let you kind of tell from your vantage point.
So after I turned down the touring management gig for the Stones, I came back to LA, and then about 3 months later, the Stones came to LA to get ready to do this tour and to finish mixing their album and getting it ready. And so in late January, Mick's secretary asked me to come to dinner at their house. And she said, Mick has always liked the album covers that you've made for the band and wonders if you have any ideas for an album cover for Exile on Main Street. So I had heard some of the music and it was very bluesy and, you know, it was very American music. And so as I was going out the door to go to his house, I picked up this book called The Americans by Robert Frank, who's this iconic Swiss photographer who had traveled across America in 1955 and taken these amazing pictures, which are like a cowboy next to a jukebox or a black preacher by the side of the Mississippi River praying. And, you know, just extraordinary images. So I go up and we have a nice dinner at Mick's house in Bel Air. And I said to him, look, everyone knows what the Rolling Stones looks like. You don't need your own picture on the cover. Why don't you put one of these pictures from Robert Frank's book on the cover? Like this picture of this cowboy next to the jukebox. And Mick starts going through the book and he's just, wow, these pictures are amazing. And he lifts his head and he says, John, let's get this guy to take our picture. And he said, that's not the idea. The idea is use one of his pictures. I said, these were taken in 1955. I don't even know if he's still alive. And he said, well, if he is, you can find him because you offer him $20,000 to take the Rolling Stones picture. He'll show up. I promise you. So I went home. And the next morning, I call around and it turns out he's left New York City and moved in with his daughter in Maybu, Nova Scotia. And I figured, well, where is that? You know, and I thought, well, I'll just call Directory Assistance.
Maybu, a little 411. Can you put me in touch with this number?
It is phone number, right? Well, it turned out that was not possible. It turned out that Maybu is such a small town that there's a party line. And most of your listeners don't know what that is, but it meant that there was a central operator in the town and you would call into the town and she would plug you into the phone for the Frank residence. So I call and I get to this central operator and she says, you can't talk to the Franks because there was a big storm here and the wires are all down. And I said, well, when are the wires going to be back up? And she says, oh, in a couple of months when the storm's in. I said, well, that's not going to help. So she said, well, I could put you through to the general store because his daughter comes in once a week to pick up supplies. So I get connected to the general store. And it turns out his daughter was actually there. So I talked to her and I convinced her that this wasn't some joke, that there was really $20,000 waiting for her father if he would show up in LA. And she says, okay, he'll call you tomorrow, but he has to call you collect. I mean, in other words, they were on their bottom dollar. And so eventually I get him to LA. The Stones put him up at the Beverly Hills Hotel in a suite. You know, he's living in high cotton. And we go up to Mick's house and he regales Mick with these stories of the Beats and Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac and all these characters that he'd hung out with. And Mick is just thinking, this guy is the greatest. And this goes on for 4 or 5 days. We have these dinners every night. And one night I saw him in the study and he was rummaging in a trash bin and putting stuff in his pocket. And I didn't know what he was doing, but anyway. So eventually the manager, Marshall Chess, gets so pissed off. He's saying, get this old fucker to take a picture. Come on. So we go downtown to Grand Central Market. And of course, Keith is late and the light is fading and he gets about 3 pictures and that's it. And then the manager totally explodes. Says, this is total amateur hour. Send him home. So Mick says, okay, you can send him home, but give him the $20,000. And the guy said, what? For what? And Mick said, just for who he is, you know? And I thought that was amazing, you know? So
that is pretty cool. You hear artists who are pompous and cheap and whatever, and this is just the opposite.
I take him to the airport. I give him his check for $20,000. And I figured, well, it was interesting to meet Robert Frank. He was a hero of mine, but that was a total disaster. So 2 weeks later, the entire album cover for Exile on Main Street shows up, which is a 1mm film that Robert had shot, scraps of paper that Mick had written lyrics on, old pictures of Robert Frank, other things. And it was like a Rauschenberg collage. And it was so good that it won the Grammy for Best Album Cover of the Year that year.
In the remaining moments, which aren't too many that we have left, by the way, we're talking on Rock Conversations with Jonathan Taplin. His book, The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life, is a fantastic read. Let's talk a little politics without getting too partisan. But you obviously, I think maybe going back to your prep school days, developed a real social, I won't even say a political, but a social conscience. You referenced earlier in our interview how the deaths of the 1960s affected you, the 2 Kennedys. And King, by the way, I did a film. Anytime I see someone who supported Bobby Kennedy, I kind of nod, and that's cool. But based on a documentary I worked on years ago, I'm more of a Eugene McCarthy man, even though I was too young to get clean for Gene. But did you ever have a situation with an artist, either that you liked or with whom you were working, where you might have wanted them to do something a little more overtly political and they didn't really want to?
Not really, because by the time I started working for Bob Dylan, he had already transitioned away from political kind of protest songs into the more personal work, like a Rolling Stone and stuff like that. And, you know, I think every artist makes their own decision that way on what they need to do. What I will say is that the convergence of politics and culture in the early 60s was pretty strong and powerful. And sometimes I wonder if it's not missing now. I would say if I looked at what the events of last summer, of Black Lives Matter, and last fall of attempts to get people registered to vote, I saw more visibility from LeBron James than I saw from Jay-Z. And in that sense, I think that maybe in the social contract, the musicians have taken a more subsidiary role than maybe the basketball players, which is interesting. And I don't know really why that is, but it is. And that's probably something we ought to ponder.
And I have the same opinion to a large extent. And I shared that when I was doing our episode that saluted Bob Dylan on his 80th. And one of the guests was a professor, is a professor at George Washington University, Gail Wald. And she corrected me. And I think rightly so. She said, there are a lot of good artists who are doing a lot of good, for lack of a better description, protest music, you know, music with a backbone. It's just that the genre is not one that I listen to. It's hip hop. So, you know, clearly I'm missing that. And so I don't doubt that it's occurring. I wish I were seeing it a little more in some of the rock and roll bands. And maybe we just don't have those bands making new music like we used to. Those that, you know, grow up with any sort of real social or political conviction. There right. is one that's still going strongly that has taken stances over the years, and you speak very highly of them. U2. I want to read something as we kind of jump from page to page in our waning moments of this interview, page 235, if you're keeping track at home. Once in 2016, these are your words, not mine, after I had written an op-ed in the New York Times entitled, "Do You Love Music? Silicon Valley Doesn't," I got a wonderful email from Bono asking how he could help the cause. Talk about the cause and where, what did Bono do to help, and where do you see it now? Because it seems to be a continually evolving sort of situation.
Well, I mean, what's obvious is that musicians have not benefited from the internet and the rise of social media. Revenues for music have fallen from, say, $20 billion a year to $11 billion a year. And I can't think of another industry that's had that kind of a contraction that didn't just collapse. And the only way you can look at it is that once music became free, in other words, once I could find anything I want on YouTube for free, the need to purchase music kind of went away. Now, a lot of people still have a, you know, Apple Music account or a Spotify premium account, and that does help the music ecosystem to some extent, but it's not a substitute for the way music was. And exactly why the disruptors of the internet decided that music was the thing that should be free, but not food or not books or not something else, I don't really know, except the fact that obviously the file size of a song is pretty small. And so your ability to put it all on a server, infinite amount of music, is pretty easy and cheap. So, you know, I wrote another book called Move Fast and Break Things, which is really about how Google and Amazon and Facebook have kind of decimated not only the creative world, but also the political world. And so whether it's a net positive or a net negative is probably for history to decide. But I would say one thing. If Facebook had existed in 1955, we'd probably still have polio. Because if you really look at where the 30% of the Americans who refuse to get vaccinated, where are they getting their information? It's from Facebook. It's not from Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson, if he's lucky, reaches a million people a night. Facebook reaches 200 million people a day.
So let's circle back, if we could, and go back to the band, because you were so integral in their rise. I want to talk to you to get your reaction or your memories of your first reaction when you first heard not only The Weight, but other songs from The Big Pink. And then tell me, too, how you saw other musicians and artists react to that album.
So Music from Big Pink is a real breakthrough album in the sense that if you think about what was really being played on the alternative radio stations at that period was like the Jefferson Airplane and Big Brother and the Holding Company and things like that. And so music from Big Pink is a real break from that. It's kind of rooted in, now we call it Americana. We didn't have that term in those days, but it had real specific roots in kind of earlier ways that music were being made. And in that sense, it had also a kind of rough sound to it. And that really came out of the way that the band had always recorded. And even if you listen to the famous basement tapes that they did with Bob Dylan in a home recording studio on a two-track recorder, it has that same kind of rough harmony singing, call and response, all of those gestures that are so important. And so I think for a lot of musicians, it was really a breath of fresh air. I know that the music from Big Pink was a huge influence on their work in terms of the simplicity of it and in terms of the fact that it didn't have long 3-minute guitar solos or anything like that. It was nothing like Cream, what Eric had been doing before that. And so I think it really changed things a lot.
Jonathan Taplin, his book is The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life. I highly encourage you check it out because it's a great read. It took me about a day to get through it. So that's always a good sign, right?